2511 User Experience. And today we're going to be looking at Chapter 7, Modeling Requirements. So, we've gathered the requirements using participant observation, maybe task analysis, or we've done some questionnaires or interviews, those kind of things. How do we now capture that information, which is very informal and unstructured in a lot of ways? Certainly it's not good enough to give to a software engineer and expect them to be able to develop code from it. How are we going to model that information to get rid of logical inconsistencies, to make sure that we know just exactly what it is that people want? And how are we going to then move that information over so that a software engineer can help and can look at that? Now, again, as with everything, it's a spectrum. So we have things that are informal methods, and then we have things that are more formal methods. And you have to decide, really based on the development process, just how much you want to make the software engineer conform to what you explicitly want with their software engineering, or whether or how much latitude they can have with regard to the user experience, with certainly for how they're going to develop the code base. And that just depends on the situation that you're in. So for instance, informal methods, we have things like user stories, whereby this is really just a sort of a structured way of deciding or making statements about what can happen with regard to a transaction, for instance. So as we can see from the visual examples, a company can pay for a job posting with a credit card, and then you have got a note, accepts Visa, MasterCard. Now then on the back, you can write a load of stuff for the software engineer, but typically this is just too much. They don't need that level of information. And what is much better is to really cut that down to sort of, in some ways, ask questions, and also to, in some ways, understand what the, give some help to the software engineer based on stuff that you know, such as if you know that the card type can be derived from the first two digits of the card, for instance. You can then have things called use cases, and I think we've seen those pretty much in software engineering, so I don't intend to go into those too much in too much detail here on this little podcast snack. So generally, a use case gives you a bit more formality to the informal user story, in my opinion. There's lots more kind of aspects that are specified to give a broader understanding of what the use case is and what it's supposed to solve. And you'll see here that there are specific terms, as we've discussed before, such as the primary actor, which is the person who's going to be using the product, the stakeholders, typically these are employed by the businesses, etc., and the roles, of course, that these people fulfill. We then have personas and scenarios. Now, personas and scenarios are slightly different. A persona describes the characteristics of a particular user. Typically, it's not a real user, but it's a composite. And the task that they want to do is a scenario. They're in a scenario, and this is how they want to solve that scenario, which typically your work is going to do. Now, when we think about that, we also need to realise that these personas and scenarios typically might not be, you could create them for each specific task, etc., but it's much better to create a bunch of cards with different scenarios and different people on them, different personas on them, and then to distribute them to the software engineers, to the developers, and just so that they can have them with them all the time when they're developing, such that they can quickly flick back and look at the kind of, familiarize themselves with the kind of people and the kind of tasks that you've captured. So you create composites of your users, of the people that have given you information, and then, and also the jobs that they are needing to do. We have more semi-formal methods where we might have wireframes where we're a bit more specific. We're saying this is how we think these things should look. This is what users have decided. We've got mock-ups and storyboards whereby we get a bit more level of detail. And certainly some of these mock-ups and storyboards can look a lot more like computational work as opposed to cartoons. But they also tell you the flow that you should enact. So one thing after the next, what should the flow of the interaction be? We also have things such as post-it storyboards, whereby you've got post-it notes again, where these are created with users because they're easy to throw away and change around. These look a lot more informal because they're done on a post-it note, and they've got scrawl on them, they've got handwritten notes, but they're actually not. They are semi-formal, sometimes more formal than you might imagine. So don't be surprised, and don't be surprised or fooled by the fact that some things are created by a machine, and so you give them a more priority. Oh, this is more formal than this thing created by hand. It typically isn't like that. So you have to just really look at the value of the concepts expressed in the in this aspect. You also have the concept of priority poker. So there are a set of things that you'll have that you typically might a set of scenarios or set of things that will be developed, and you might go through with users going through to get them to rank what they think is the most important using these kind of priority poker cards that you can get. So therefore, you can rank things in priority order based on what users think are the most priority, the main priorities. So therefore, you can get a user-related minimum viable product, I would say. Now, you also got to realize that there are things like Moscow grids. So typically, these are quite interesting. So this is must, should, could, and won't. So things that you must implement, things that you should implement if you've got the time, things that you could implement, but you're probably not going to this time because maybe that's for version two, and the things that you definitely won't implement this time because it's too esoteric or there's not enough people that want it. And then you move on to formal methods, which might be flowcharts, which we've seen, and from flowcharts and data, certainly data flow models, you can typically create databases, you can typically create system software, etc. And in some cases, you can typically create a minimal or at least a starting user interface. And then we also have things like state transition diagrams and the unified modeling language, so UML diagrams as well, which allow us to specify the way that systems work in very, very formal detail. So there's not much wiggle room in the software for the software engineers or developers. And maybe the software engineers and developers will be the people helping you to create these UML diagrams and flowchart diagrams and state transition diagrams, and then all you can typically do is press the button and it will generate program logic for you. Remember again, this does definitely looks like a hierarchy or at least a spectrum of informal methods to formal methods, but you don't have to go from one end to the other. You might decide to stop at semi-formal methods because that's enough to give to your developers because you want to give them some latitude in how they do their work. It might be that things like the database can be created using something like a data flow diagram, but the other stuff, the actual real stuff to do with the user interface, should be created using the storyboard, which is at two different levels in, if you like, in the spectrum. Just as well, I'd like you to draw your attention to the caveat of Alan Dix, where he talks about the dangers of mediocrity and groupthink. I think this is really important, that it can be very easy to get everybody's opinion, and then you just come up with some mediocre piece of work. You know, you wouldn't design art by community. It would be something that's done out of the intensity of the emotion of the person, you know, their belief in their design, and so you also have to balance that as well, and also that you need to make sure, and we will do this at the in part four of the notes. You need to make sure that the system that you've developed actually meets the specification that you've been given by the requirement solicitation after it's been developed. This is tricky because there's a lot of stages here, and so there's a lot of space for things to get lost, and so it's useful to have users with you along the way, even though they might just be giving the formal shake of the head, yes, this is the right thing we thought about, this is or this is a different thing we thought about. But you must always do a fair assessment of the evaluation at the end. Mostly, bits of your system will be found to be good and correct, and some bits will found to be, you know, incorrect. It just means that those incorrect things might be corrected. You still might release the minimum viable product, but then you might correct those things in the next iteration of the design lifecycle for the UX. Okay, and with that, our design part has now been complete, and we'll move on in the next podcast to building the user experience and discuss how we start off with developing for user experience.